Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a history of the truly weird advice given to parents over the centuries, from drinking through labor to comforting babies with teethers made out of animal fangs. Jennifer Traeg is my guest this hour. She's a writer and a mother of two who was stunned to discover how exhausting it is to do even a halfway decent job of raising kids. So she wondered, has it always been this hard? And who's to say we're getting it right now? Our conversation starts after the news. Okay, fellow parents, we all want the best for our kids, right? It's human instinct to nurture them, protect them from harm, teach them what they need to know to one day survive in this world without us. But straight talk here, did you have any idea it would be so hard? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You wonder sometimes, did previous generations of parents worry as much as we do about whether they were doing it right? Did they exhaustively research vaccination schedules and food additives or spend weeks every spring planning consecutive stimulating summer enrichment? Because I was well-loved growing up, but my memories of childhood include a lot of entirely unsupervised days of playing outside with no sunscreen and no water bottle, a fair amount of secondhand smoke, and at least a touch of the Betty Draper approach to child-rearing.
Sally!
Sally, stop it.
Go bang your head against the wall.
Sally looks fat.
Sally, go watch TV.
Go watch TV, both of you.
She's a child. She'll get over it.
It's tempting to think of raising kids as one more thing we have made unnecessarily hard and complicated in the 21st century. Author Jennifer Traeg discovered otherwise. Her new book is called Act Natural, A Cultural History of Misadventures in Parenting. She joins us from the studios of Michigan Public Radio to talk about it. Jennifer, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It should make us all feel a little better that you confirmed parents have always found parenting hard, at least based on the evidence that many of us have tried to lighten the burden over the centuries.
Yes, I think it's been hard for everyone. I think we are among the earliest generations beat ourselves up about it. Previous generations really viewed having kids as their job, but not necessarily raising them. And when something went wrong, they weren't blamed. You know, it would be the blame would be on a curse or, you know, just bad luck, but not because you didn't pay enough attention to your kids.
I was a little stunned by how often parents in ancient Rome just abandoned their newborns.
Yeah, it was widespread. It's thought that most families abandoned at least one child.
And it's grim, but you note that mothers who couldn't care for more children killed their babies after birth because there was no such thing then as a safe abortion.
Right. It was basically very, very, very late term abortion or birth control. It was, you know, the safest method of reducing family size. They would abandon children, sometimes on a dung heap, sometimes in a designated spot. And the children would either be adopted by other families, sold into slavery, sometimes eaten by wildlife.
All right, let's talk about wet nurses. This was the situation that outsourced the task of breastfeeding to somebody other than the infant's mother. I guess I always assumed the wet nurse like lived with the family to do that job, but in fact, babies were usually sent away for years.
Yeah, it's just of everything I learned when I was researching the book, this is what shocked me. The numbers are insane, and it sort of reached its peak in the 18th century in France. In the year 1780, there were 17,000 babies born in Paris, and only 700 were nursed by their mothers. The rest were sent to the country. It would sort of be like if almost every child born in Dallas this year were sent to Hill Country, where they would be lodged with a family no one had ever met until the child was about 5 years old.
Yeah, and there was a wagon that would go around and right. pick these babies up. Explain how that worked.
Right. It was called a manure. A very complicated process. When you found out you were pregnant, you would go to a woman called a recommanderess who would, it was sort of an agency that would find you a wet nurse in the country. And then when the baby was born, this guy was essentially, a hobo on a pack mule named the Meneur who would show up and throw the baby in a basket and take the baby along with all the other babies out to the country and drop them off at the wet nurse.
Doesn't it seem like they'd get mixed up a lot?
They did, yeah. Ooh. And sometimes they fell out. Yeah, it was not a good system.
So I knew that wealthy British parents had a habit of sending their kids away to school for a long time, but the children of poor families also let their kids go early.
Right. You know, and I think there it wasn't choice just to support the family. Kids had to go into service early.
Hmm. So what did Enlightenment philosophy have to do with the turnaround in British thinking about the obligations they had to their children?
Yeah, so it was Locke and Rousseau, and they really changed everything in some ways for the better, and some ways they made things much harder. So those were basically the earliest advice books for parents. They weren't supposed to be. They're philosophical treatises, but it was the closest thing that parents had, and it kind of shows how desperate people were that they took these heavy philosophical tomes for, you know, the 16th and 17th century version of Dr. Spock. And these two got rid of some things that had been really bad, like really, really, really heavy swaddling. Infants had been basically imprisoned in straitjackets up to that point, and they encouraged parents to do away with that, which was great. They encouraged breastfeeding, which was great. And they also encouraged parents to oversee the child rearing, which was entirely new. It just hadn't really happened before. And it became very popular, especially Rousseau was sort of the toddler yoga of the era, and something that all, you know, well-off and trendy parents did. But he had some really terrible ideas, and he advocated a course of hardening for your child. So he wanted them outdoors all year, preferably shoeless, in scanty clothing. He wanted them dipped in cold water. He suggested you surprise them with spiders and pistol shots.
Wow.
And fright masks to frighten them and to toughen them up.
Did either of these guys have intimate experience raising children?
So Locke had no kids. Rousseau had, I think it was 6 or 7, and he gave every single one of them up to a foundling home. He didn't know their names. I don't think he knew their genders, but apparently he was a good dog owner.
Hmm. So, well, there you go. In the United States, particularly the South, enslaved parents often relied on the community to help them bring up their children because their masters didn't ever give them time to do the job themselves.
Right. Enslaved populations in the South, it was sort of a different form of community parenting, much more sinister form, because there were no alternatives. Children would be in slave situations, be watched by someone who was too old to work, or sometimes by someone who was too young to work, until they themselves were old enough to join the workforce.
Hmm. How did child psychology start to be something that parents considered as they made decisions about what their kids needed?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I mean, you know, really, it's not until fairly recently at all that you gave any thought to a child's cognitive development. You would, you know, no more than you gave thought to your furniture's cognitive development. But around the turn of the 20th century, something called scientific parenting came to the fore, and the thinking was that you would apply, the great leaps in science that we've made in all sorts of fields to the most important task of parenting, which included nutrition and behavior and certainly psychology.
Yeah, we'll get to some of those things specifically, but I'll just suffice it to say that there have been authoritative tomes written for centuries full of bizarre advice starting in pregnancy, when we should note that doctors for a long time knew almost nothing about obstetrics.
No, and most of the early obstetrics books are written by monks who probably had less, I'm guessing, OBGYN experience than anyone else. And they're full of very, very bad ideas and just the barest grasp on human anatomy.
How commonly did women die in childbirth before modern medicine?
It kind of depends on how you look at it. The numbers are lower than I would have thought, but still much higher than they are now. And it varied from place to place and year to year. Over the course of a woman's life, it adds up to about 1 in 10. So say, you know, 3 of the kids in my son's second grade class would have been motherless.
Hmm. But it stands to reason that, you know, the human race wouldn't have survived if we hadn't figured out how to get most of those children born alive and keep their mothers alive. But a lot of babies died in the beginning, even when there was kind of medicalized childbirth, because doctors paid attention only to the mothers.
Yeah, that's just shocking to me. They did a great job in reducing maternal mortality, which was wonderful, and they completely ignored the babies. And it was a while before someone, you know, looked into it. It was an anesthesiologist named Virginia Apgar, and most people are familiar with the Apgar test, which is the first test your child is given when they're born that assesses their breathing and their color and their response rate. And it wasn't, you know, it was not complicated science. It involved looking at the child and then actually responding to their needs. And infant mortality rates just plummeted after that was instituted.
It occurs to you that the Apgar test may have been the beginning of, like, competitive parenting. And it is, I remember when my son was born, I was like, what did he get on the Apgar? As if it's the SAT or something, because you want not just a healthy baby, but the healthiest baby in the nursery that day.
I've heard of parents arguing with the doctor. They're bargaining, yeah.
You know, it's funny. I thought Apgar, I assumed that that was some kind of acronym. I didn't know it was someone's name.
No, we're very lucky that her name just fits it perfectly. So they tailored it to her name, Virginia Apgar.
My guest is author Jennifer Traig. We're talking about her new book, Act Natural, A Cultural History of Misadventures in Parenting. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Jennifer Traig, who's got a new book out called Act Natural, A Cultural History of Misadventures in Parenting. You can join our conversation at 800-933-5372. I want to mention this just because the name is funny. Probably a lot of happy, healthy people walking around today who owe their lives to one William Smellie. What was his contribution to obstetrics?
Oh, thank you for bringing him up. He's one of my favorites. And as it turns out, the ancestor of one of my friends who at some point the family changed the name to Smellie, which is much better. So he's considered sort of the father of modern midwifery, as oxymoronic as that sounds. And he was the best known, most successful obstetrician in England and Scotland of his day, which is in the 18th century. And he is sort of who brought men into the delivery room. There hadn't really been much of a male presence before. He set up sort of these learning annex schools where men could train to be midwives for, you know, so many shillings and then go into business for themselves. And many did. They were often veterans of recent wars. And no one really knows why, if this was to make his patients more comfortable or just some strange peccadillo of his, but he would attend births dressed as a woman in a gown.
Wow. But he didn't live as a woman the rest of the time.
No, not at all. No, that was just his delivery outfit.
All right. So my grandmother had her kids in the 1940s, and I remember when I was pregnant, her advice to me was to remember, doll, that even a lemon is fattening. Like she had been told to gain almost no weight during pregnancy, and it turns out this has been advice given to women periodically, even though it is not, I don't think, recommended by any doctors now. Will you tell us about Patricia Cloyd Carter?
Oh, she's another one of my favorites. So she is basically the first free birther. So free birthing is giving birth not only at home, but alone, you know, without your partner, without a midwife, without any helpers. And she wrote a book called Come Gently, Sweet Lucina, and self-published it, explaining how to do this. She had, I think, maybe 7 kids herself, and she'd given birth to most of them at home after she'd had a couple bad experiences with her first children, and they were bad. She wasn't treated well. Her infant was scalded. They mixed up the babies. One child got a case of impetigo. So she decided to do this on her own at home and came up with a method. And her method was to, one, keep the baby as small as possible, which she did by smoking continuously through the pregnancy and severely limiting her calories and wearing a girdle to really, as she said, keep that rascal in place. And then instead of an epidural, she drank through the deliveries and delivered by herself at home with whiskey highballs.
Wow. I don't want to be too flip about this, but it's like if you have six kids running around, maybe you tell everyone you want to deliver alone so you can have like a few hours to yourself.
It had never occurred to me, but now that makes sense. Yes.
Who was behind the advice that physical affection from parents was dangerous to child development?
That was the behaviorist. In particular, it was a psychologist named John Watson, who, you know, his ideas now are so strange to us. It's hard to believe that they were once mainstream. They, in the early part of the 20th century, they were completely accepted. He was, in fact, the head of the APA. And he published a number of books really arguing that the worst thing you can do with your children is to be physically affectionate with them. You will spoil them. And recommended a completely hands-off approach. He dreamed of a day when children would be raised in sort of factories rather than by their own parents.
Is there evidence that lots of people followed that advice?
You know, some did. In fact, and even some very prominent people, Bertrand Russell, for instance, and I think the Spocks may have started out with his book, but quickly abandoned it for their own children. But, you know, when the premier psychologist in the country is telling you, no, this is what science says you should do, you listen.
You just wonder, you know, about these generations of people who were raised, I don't want to be sexist here, but with fathers in particular who couldn't say I love you to their children. And I wonder if that's not a lingering effect of that advice.
Oh, yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Yeah, I think that's we've been slow to catch up there. It's nice to see that starting to change.
So Dr. Spock came along like a deep breath of fresh air. What did he tell parents?
He said, you're doing fine, which was wonderful. He said, trust your instincts. And that's something that parents really needed to hear. There was a lot of anxiety at the time. And he sort of gave parents permission to do what was made sense for them, what felt right, and what was not exhausting and contrary to their every natural impulse.
But then, you know, by the late 60s, when the counterculture had taken hold, a lot of people turned around and said, ugh, we spoiled these babies with the Spock method.
Right. Spocked when they should have been spanked. It's not really fair to him. He got blamed for it when he never said a lot of the things that he was charged with. The one thing he did say is that you could sometimes let kids decide when they want to eat. And from that, people heard, let them do whatever they want, whenever they want. But that's not what he actually said. And he spent a lot of his later career trying to point out that, no, children need discipline.
How has our understanding of babies' intellectual capacity evolved over time, especially in like those first couple years, first 3 years?
We've learned so much about how kids' brains work, and it's incredibly enviable. They're so plastic. They're learning so much faster than we are. They have more synapses. Their world is just exploding because they have a whole world to make sense of. It was fun for me to watch my kids. When they make mistakes, you kind of see how their brain works. You can also understand why, you know, I would give them a plate of food and they would ignore everything but the ketchup, and you know, which would drive me crazy. But to them, like, it's all presented on one plate. Why should they think that's not the main dish? Why should they think you have to eat that on something with a spoon and not just scoop it up with their hands?
Where did timeout come from?
That's recent, it comes from, I believe, animal training. Some of the more effective techniques come from behavior modification techniques used on animals. That's one of them. And I think the word actually is a military term that applied to pilots. Grounding.
Oh, okay.
Grounding. Yeah, timeout doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah. So does timeout work?
I guess it varies from kids to kids, from kid to kid. I think parents like it because when everybody gets a break, it's relatively harmless. It is sometimes effective. We stopped doing it very early on because my kids liked it. They were very excited. They go, oh, I got a timeout. So it was ineffective in our case. But for some people, it definitely works.
These days, most American kids, anyway, are fully potty trained around the age of 3. What did previous generations, what have other cultures done to get that done by 18 months or even younger? How is that possible?
Well, necessity, for one. I mean, we do it because we can, because disposable diapers, maybe not great for the environment, but are incredibly convenient. And they're much easier than actually committing to potty training, which takes work and is something we all tend to put off as long as possible. But previous generations got it done much faster because they had cloth diapers, and those can be a real pain. Or they had no diapers, which was even worse. Yeah. In some cultures, still no diapers. In large parts of Asia, children just sort of wear open pants and go wherever they are.
Did Freud have anything to do with holding off because people were terrified of, you know, doing it wrong and creating a child who was anal retentive or anal expulsive?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, before the stakes were much lower. I mean, if you messed up, you had to do some laundry. But with Freud, suddenly, like, you're going to ruin, you're going to create a psychopath if you don't do this correctly.
There are few greater sources of anxiety, I think, for parents of young children than having a picky eater. But given the just the bizarre advice handed down over the years, it's no wonder that children have a reputation for refusing to eat. Just give us a smorgasbord of the kind of crazy diet advice that you've read that kids have been given or parents have been given for their kids.
Yeah, it was kind of fun for me I have a very picky eater, to read old nutritional advice for kids, because it's basically the exact opposite of what we hear now. Most books get really, really uptight about, especially about fruit, also about vegetables. There's a lot of debate about whether children should be fed them at all, what time of day they're acceptable, what time of year, if you are going to serve them, and you shouldn't, but if you have to, you really have to stew them until they just are mush. And it was because, you know, vitamins hadn't been discovered. So these were just considered empty calories that may, you know, have some dangerous side effects.
Wow. And what's this about somebody who thought that babies should be eating solid food before they leave the hospital and bacon and eggs at 9 weeks? Yeah. I just don't even understand how you could do that.
So that was a pediatrician named Walter Sackett, who was writing in, I think it was in the late 60s. And he had this drastically accelerated timeline for getting kids on real foods. And starting before they left the hospital and eating, you know, minestrone by a few weeks old. Make of it what you will, this was right around the time that prepared foods for children came on the market, huh. Baby foods came on the market. And the timeline for eating suddenly accelerated drastically.
The whole prepared baby foods thing has always baffled me. And I recognize that they're convenient and not everyone has time to get out the blender or mash things up. But it seems like we were convinced as a generation of parents that these were necessary. But it's really just the same foods we're eating, but they've been pureed more.
Right. There was a time they got a little more creative, not in a good way. There was a full line of baby desserts that were happily discontinued. But it's just the peas.
My guest is author Jennifer Traig. We're talking about her new book, Act Natural, A Cultural History of Misadventures in Parenting. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Jennifer Traig. Her new book is called Act Natural, A Cultural History of Misadventures in Parenting. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Let's go on the phone right now to Angela in Irving. Hi, Angela.
Hello. I was listening to your guest, and it just brought something back to me, and I just wanted her perspective on this. Growing up, I have an African background. Our parents taught us that we should start potty training right from when the babies come out. Whenever you're feeding them, there's this little round pot that they made specially for that reason, that you sit under the baby and they potty.
Huh.
And I potty trained my kids by the time they were 9 months old.
My hat is off to you, Angela. Thank you so much for calling. So I guess it's still happening in the current era, Jennifer.
I'm impressed. Yeah, that's great. Wow. There is something called elimination communication, which is similar, which gets kids out of diapers pretty early, where you just look to your kids. You learn your kids, I need a potty expression, and you put them on as soon as you see the face, which sounds somewhat similar. I have not tried it.
Most parents today would be loath to admit they have a favorite child, but previous generations, other societies would think that's ridiculous.
Yeah. The idea that you would treat your children the same is maybe 100 years old. For previous generations, that would be like, you know, as I say in the book, treating your doorman and your husband the same just because they're both men. Children had different roles in the family. Usually there was primogeniture in place, which meant that, you know, the whatever inheritance there was would go to the first child, who would play a very different role than younger children. Boys and girls played incredibly different roles. And the idea that you would love all your children the same and treat them the same is very recent.
So now parents won't admit to having a favorite child, but if you press them and they tell you, and then you ask their kids to guess, kids tend to guess wrong who the parents' favorites
right.
are.
There's only been a few studies on this, and they're small, but they're telling. And something like 80% of parents will admit that they have a favorite child. The kids know this. The kids, about 80% of kids will say, yeah, my parents have a favorite. But they get the kid wrong. That's really interesting to me.
Often the explanation for sibling rivalry is that children are competing for their parents' affection. In my experience, it's never that. They're not that interested in what I have going on. What do siblings fight about?
Toys.
Huh?
That's what the research shows, at least today. Yeah, it's. I think it's something like 90% of the time it's over toys, and then 10% of the time it's over you. Yeah.
It is an interesting phenomenon, though, and it's so frustrating for parents to see the people they love best, like, scrapping in the living room.
Yes. And, you know, and my sister and I fought terribly, so I really should have expected it. But then when I had my second child, and suddenly there were two of them, and they're both lovely, and they treat everyone else in the world wonderfully, and oh, did they turn on each other. It's shocking.
I think I've read that it's good experience for children to sort of learn how to manage conflict, not that they do it very well when they're in elementary school.
Yeah, I think so. I always tell them that, like, you know, you're really learning how to get along in the world by getting along with each other. I don't know that they believe me, but.
All right, back to the phones now. Ron is calling from Carroll. Hi, Ron.
Well, I guess we're going to have a potty day. Potty training.
All right.
Two of my own back in were born in 93 and 95, and I did not have nearly the techno that there is involved now. I'm seeing now where you're seeing kids that basically don't even know how to go to the potty, but they know how to push buttons and play games on electrical devices. I wonder how your guest is, and thank you for taking my call, feels about the changing roles of parents and electronic devices and how that's going to affect the parenting in next generations to come.
Thanks for calling, Ron.
When you were talking earlier about, I was wondering what it is you're doing as a parent today that your kids will not believe that you did, the terrible, dangerous thing you did. I think it's going to be the screens. I think it's going to be the technology. And I think there's a filmmaker, Tiffany Schlein, and she says, 30 years from now, the Mad Men of that era is going to show all the parents on the phones and the kids on the phones and the phones at the table and in the bedroom and everywhere. And I think right now, we're in such a phase of unchecked use that later generations may be a little shocked by how much we ever did it. I haven't checked. I'm nearly certain, though, there must be a potty training app. There's no phase of life or parenting that hasn't been affected by technology. Yeah.
It does stand to reason that we're going to overuse this now in the same way that, I don't know if you and I are about the same age, but our parents, at least my parents, did not have TV limited really at all. It was limited less for me than it was for my kids. And then we started to realize it's not okay. And maybe over time we'll figure out reasonable limits on tech use for small children.
Yeah, that's the one I struggle with the most for sure, because it is the cheapest and most effective babysitter I have. Uh-huh. And sometimes I absolutely need it, but I know it's at a cost that when they're doing that, they're not doing things that are much better for them.
All right, let's go back to the phones and speak with Kate in Fort Worth. Hi, Kate.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask the guest, there seems to be an ongoing pressure to have our children progress academically. I think mostly I notice it in reading earlier and earlier and earlier. And I'm curious if that's just the times and that's historically been the way it is. But I'm also curious if we're finding that we're creating more anxiety and more emotional issues in our children by expecting more of them earlier.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I think you're right on both counts. The previous generations did not give really much thought at all to their children's neurological or cognitive development. It just was not a priority. It was not considered their job. Now we put a ton of energy into it. We put pretty much all our energy into it. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the rates of anxiety are skyrocketing as well.
I can't let this conversation end without talking about the craziness around sleep. Maybe you can start by describing the baby cage that Eleanor Roosevelt had made for her young daughter.
Right. I'd heard about it, and I kind of doubted the story until I saw the pictures. And, oh, yeah, it was a real thing. Earlier generations, the thing that they really worried about, and sometimes for good reason, was fresh air. And at the time, there were a lot of pollutants in the air and, the pollutants in the home, and getting your kids some fresh air was not a bad idea. But that meant putting them out to nap in the air. And if you lived in an apartment, it meant you installed basically a chicken coop that attached to the window and had the child nap in that. And they were considered, very forward thinking and what the best parents did.
There are a few things that get people more riled up than judgment of how they're trying to get their kids to sleep.
Yeah. I think it's because, if you're having that fight, you're sleep deprived. As I am today. We did not have a great night last night. The Ferberization, the letting the cry it out thing is mm-hmm. remains probably the best way to get in a fight with other parents on the internet. I can see both sides. You know what works for your kid. But teaching them to sleep, which you think would just be a natural thing, it turns out to be just a lot of work.
So I have to ask you, I know your kids are relatively young. Were they in daycare or in school? How did you get this book written?
I know. Well, it took me 5 years, which was, as I kept complaining, the subject matter is impeding the progress. I actually did a lot of the work in Texas while we were on a sabbatical there and found some wonderful daycare centers in Austin that helped me get the book done.
The new book by author Jennifer Traeg is called Act Natural, A Cultural History of Misadventures in Parenting. Jennifer, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for making this time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me.